From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Yes, thank you very much, Ollie Barrett. Thanks a lot. It's the 15th of April 2019, Monday's programme. I hope you've had a nice weekend. I hope you're in good form and in fine fettle. This is your Richie Allen Show. Anytime between now and the end of the programme, you can tweet me. It's at Richie Allen Show. Loads to talk about today. Got a terrific week of guests lined up for you starting today. Welcome one and all.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, a very old friend of mine joins the program this hour. Peter Tatchell, human rights legend, human rights campaigner, will join me. We'll be talking about Israel Folau, the Australian rugby union player fired over comments he's made about gay and lesbian folks, but others as well. We'll talk about that with Peter. We'll also talk about Julian Assange at Belmarsh Prison, the implications of that for free speech, and much more this hour as well. It is your Richie Allen Show for Monday. I will have a big news roundup as well a bit later on in the programme. Let's just get rid of the music. Informed we have been in this neighbourhood by our internet providers that there might be, probably will be, an outage a little bit later on after six. So I don't know how that's going to work out. Francis Leader was due to be on the programme with me today. And in light of that news, we've decided to put Francis on Wednesday's programme. Bit of a shame, really, considering what's in the news today. But it's going to be newsworthy forever, climate change and all the rest of it. So Francis will be on. I think we'll probably be okay till around about 6:30. I'm not sure. We'll see how it goes anyway. But I've got a packed programme for you today. And as usual, I know I've said it already, I do welcome your comments, critical comments, abuse. You can send it all my way. Another lovely day here in South Manchester. The weatherman, or the weatherwoman, I have no idea who it is saying that we're going to have positively Mediterranean weather as we approach the Easter bank holiday weekend. Easter Sunday, of course, this coming Sunday. All right. But I want to start off and talk about something that's a bit personal to me. 30 years ago today, where were you 30 years ago? Do you remember? Well, I do remember, because I was in Waterford Regional Hospital, which we, those of us over a certain age, will always know as Ardkeen. It used to be called Ardkeen Hospital. Then it became Waterford Regional Hospital. And I was there. I'd been there for over 3 weeks on April 15th, 1989. I was 14 and I had double pneumonia. That was the first time I had it. I've had pneumonia three times. Not man flu, I've had serious pneumonia three times. But that time when I was 14, it was deadly. I was in hospital for nearly a month. And on the 15th of April 1989, I was getting over it. And I was coming towards the end of my stay in hospital. There I was, a schoolboy in secondary school in hospital. And I remember at that time the weather in Waterford, in the southeast of Vernon, was quite lovely at that particular time. And that day, the 15th of April 89, there was an FA Cup semi-final. That's soccer for our American and Canadian listeners. It was a massive game between Nottingham Forest, managed by Brian Clough at the time, and the hated Liverpool FC. Why do you say hated, Richie? Well, I was a naive kid then at that time, and I idolised Manchester United. I still love Manchester, of course, and I still watch Manchester United, but not with the same rose-tinted spectacles that I used to when I was younger. I idolised Brian Robson and Mark Hughes and the Irish Connection, you know, Frank Stapleton, Paul McGrath, Norman Whiteside, of course, Ashley Grimes with the lovely long, blonde, flowing, curly locks and all the rest of it. At that stage, Alex Ferguson was about 3 years into the job, and fans wanted rid of him. He was a long way away from Sir Alex Ferguson. So the hated Liverpool then, well, they were amazing, really. People like John Barnes, Peter Beardsley, Ray Houghton, a Scottish-Irish man, let's be honest about it. Great player for the Republic of Ireland. Ronnie Whelan, Alan Hansen, Stevie Nicol, Ian Rush, my God, John Aldridge, amazing team. And I hated them. I didn't really. I thought I did because I was a young boy and you want your team to do well. And we were quite a ways away from winning the league at that stage. Now, the game was live on Irish television, RTE2. It was live on RTE2. It wasn't live on UK television. This was a rather weird thing at the time. The BBC cameras were there to record it. So they were going to show it later on that evening on Match of the Day. John Motson and the gang were there to record it. But what they were recording was being streamed live on, relayed, I should say, live on Irish television. Johnny Giles would have been the co-commentator live at the game with George Hamilton or Jimmy McGee, I can't remember. And I watched it. I watched the game. I was in a room with a very senior gentleman who, believe it or not, passed away 3 days later. This lovely old man called George, who I was sharing a room with at the hospital. Bizarre time, really. And in the 6th minute of the game, a policeman ran onto the pitch and told the referee, "You've got to stop the game. Something dreadful is happening here and we've got to stop it." And in the terrace behind the Liverpool goalkeeper, the acrobatic, charismatic Bruce Grobbelaar, larger-than-life fella Bruce Grobbelaar was, that was the Leppings Lane end. And behind him, there was obviously a problem. But when you were watching it on television, it looked like a pitch invasion initially. It wasn't, but it looked like it was anyway. But it wasn't long before you could see that it wasn't, that something very serious was happening. That people in that terrace behind that goal were gasping for air and fighting for their lives. You could tell that. Excuse me. And the Irish commentary team stayed with the live, with the live pictures, and were trying to figure it out as they were going along. They were getting information as well. These days, to protect people from harm, I suppose the cameras would turn away from the pitch. They, you know, if somebody runs onto a pitch these days for any reason, they have instructed broadcasters and directors to focus away from what's happening and to protect the home audience from seeing it, which is quite ridiculous. But anyway, the people in the terrace behind the goal at Leppings Lane were fighting for their lives, and some of them were being pulled up to the next level of the stand, the second tier. There was people there trying to pull them up out of it because they were being crushed. And quite a few lives were saved because of that. I don't know how many lives were saved, but a lot were saved because of it. But in the end, 96 people lost their lives and more than 700 people were injured, some of them very seriously. They were taken into a gymnasium, many of the bodies. And as a child of 14, I say a child, I think at 14, you're hardly a child, but you're still fairly inexperienced. You just don't have a clue what's going on. And the coverage ended, and then you had the late evening news programmes and the newspapers, and everybody watched the news at 6 o'clock. We got BBC Wales in Waterford, which is on the southeast of Ireland. We got BBC Wales. We got ITV Wales, or HTV Wales as it was known then. And we watched the 6 o'clock news and we watched the 9 o'clock news. And that's where the cover-up began, or at least that's where I used to think the cover-up began. But that was the first that the public were exposed to the cover-up on the evening news that evening and then every other evening, because stories were emerging very quickly. And this is a massively important story historically. And for those trying to understand the paradigm they're living in and to understand how authority works, how power works, what the elite is and what it's capable of, this story of the Hillsborough disaster of 1989, exactly 30 years ago today, it's vital that people understand it. And I know there are people listening overseas that might never have heard much about this, and they might know about the people dying and they might have heard about a cover-up, but they might not know just how insidious it all was. So these stories kind of emerged really quickly, blaming Liverpool's fans. And they got more sensational and more disturbing. as the days went on. Newspapers said the fans are hooligans. They were pissed. They were so drunk they couldn't stand up. They were fighting and they were trying to get in without a ticket. They were trying to get access to this massive game without a ticket. They said that some of the Liverpool fans had forged tickets. They said it was the unacceptable face of hooliganism. They basically said that Liverpool Football Club supporters had killed their own. Yeah. And years later we'd find out that the police were selling this particular bullshit to the Red Tops. The Red Tops being the tabloids. And the tabloids were lapping it up with the Sun newspaper, Rupert's paper, particularly egregious, dripping poison across its pages. They published outlandish, rotten, dire tripe, like unharmed Liverpool fans were stealing from stricken fans whom were gasping their last breaths. That was an amazing image. Imagine that. Scumbags wearing Liverpool scarves were stealing the wallets of those lying on the pitch, gasping their final breath. That's what the Sun sold the world. They said that while first responders, including the police, were working on the dying, they were being attacked and impeded by Liverpool fans. Rotten. Poison. Can you imagine the families back home in Liverpool reading that? Imagine the fans who had survived. They're on their way back home to Liverpool. They're trying to come to terms with the loss of friends and neighbours and workmates. And then they realise that they're being blamed for the deaths of those fans. Kelvin McKenzie in The Sun wrote the truth right across the front page on The Sun. The truth. And it was filled with all those lies, that article. Under the banner, the truth was filled with all the lies that I just mentioned there, that they were stealing from the dead and the dying. I don't know about you, but I couldn't imagine that. I couldn't imagine the sense of injustice, the rage. What must have Liverpoolians wanted to do to the people responsible for publishing that nonsense? The truth was, ironically, that a catalogue of, to say grievous errors is putting it mildly, grievous errors by South Yorkshire Police, totally unavoidable errors, led to the deaths of those 96 innocent fans. The Liverpool fans had nothing to do with it. They didn't do anything that was responsible for the manslaughter of their own colleagues, their own neighbours, their own teammates and all the rest of it. Incredibly, the police officer in charge of the whole thing that day was a guy with no previous experience whatsoever of commanding such an event. Can you imagine that? No experience whatsoever. You're going to go into a control room and you're responsible for policing over 40,000 fans inside and outside of the stadium, even though you've never done it before. Not only have you never done it before, but you've had no training in doing it. Guy's name was David Duckenfield. No experience. He hadn't got a Scooby-Doo. Hadn't a clue. Who should have overseen it? Apparently there was a guy called Brian Mole. Vastly experienced commander on match days. Had worked at that stadium on many football semi-finals. Hugely experienced. But he'd been moved to another job fairly hastily after a disciplinary hearing in a totally unrelated matter. Move him over there and bring in a guy who had no training in football match crowd control. Not all the turnstiles that were normally open for a match like that were in fact open. North stand turnstiles that would be open to filter fans into the west stand where the Leppings Lane end was, these were closed down inexplicably. So all Liverpool supporters ended up being bottlenecked, converged into a single entrance at Leppings Lane. It's like seconds from disaster, really, isn't it? Madness. Deadly. And no excuse. no excuse for this complete ineptitude, because that stadium had had previous problems in that very end of the ground 6 years before that, when fans had been injured at another semi-final. It had nearly happened before that there was loss of life. Imagine it. So on the day, the 15th of April 1989, a bottleneck developed with more fans arriving than could be easily filtered through the turnstiles in time for the kickoff of the match. Imagine it. And some of those fans at the front of the bottleneck had tickets but were in the wrong area, but no fault of their own. It wasn't their fault, because other turnstiles that should have been open that weren't open, you had fans with tickets standing there and they couldn't turn back because there were thousands of fans behind them. Seconds from disaster we are here now. It gets worse, because a police constable who could see clearly what was going on and that disaster was possibly on the way radioed the control room to say, "Listen, lads, let's delay this game," like it had been delayed 2 years before. 2 years previous, there was another semi-final there and the game was delayed because of similar problems. So the PC, the police constable, phones up. Well, he radios up, you know, breaker, breaker or whatever. Come in, command. Yes, what's going on? Lads, you really should delay this game by a half an hour. And they said no. David Duckinfield, no. Where was Duckinfield? Why? There'd been a delay 2 years previously. It worked out fine. Would Brian Mole, the experienced football day commander, would he have delayed the game? Of course he would have delayed the game. He would have said, right, everybody relax, get on the loudspeaker system and address the fans who are congregated at that end and explain to them that the game is going to be delayed, that they should just relax and we'll get them all in. In fact, make assurances to them that the game will not kick off until they're all safely inside, right, with their hamburgers and their beers, ready to watch the game. No. No, Duckinfield and the command centre said, no, don't delay the game. And then disaster. Because they opened three large gates. Gates that would never be open. Gates that would only be open at the end of a match to give fans, to allow fans disperse in greater numbers. You know what I'm talking about. If you've ever left a football game or a concert at a football stadium, they're big, massive gates. They swing out at the end of the event. They're never open before the event. So they opened these gates and in went thousands of fans. Not drunk, not aggressive, not hooligans, but put in harm's way by unimaginable ineptitude. 96 fans died in the ensuing crush. Hundreds more were injured. And as people began dying, and they began dying on television, the cover-up began in the police control room. It didn't begin that night on the 9 o'clock news. It began in the control room. Blame the fans. Blame the fans. These are working class people. These are Liverpudlians. Scousers. They're vermin. They're shit. So blame them. And junior officers, some of them only weeks on the job, were told to change their statements after it. They were told not to write their accounts of the day in their official police pocketbooks. Imagine the corruption. Young man, how long have you been on the job? You'll do what you're told. You will not write anything about that in your official police pocketbook. You're not going to do it. And later on, years later, we found that hundreds of statements were altered. Altered. A guy called Maxwell Groom, a police constable at the time of the disaster, made allegations that there was a high-level conspiracy by Freemasons to take the blame away from David Duckinfield and to blame another superintendent who was there. Maxwell Groom, a police constable, said there was a meeting of Freemasons later on to protect Duckinfield. Freemasons, can you imagine it? And we later found out that the match commander with no experience whatsoever, Duckenfield, was in fact a Freemason who became a Freemason in 1975, and he became worshipful master of his local lodge a year after the Hillsborough disaster. And amazingly, during the second coroner's hearing, Sir John Goldring presiding told the jury to disregard the Masonic connections and the attempt to cover up what had happened on the day and protect Duckenfield. It went right to the heart of the government, right to the door of number 10 Downing Street. And this is why it's so important that people never forget what happened that particular day. Because the fact that they were caught out, and the fact that it took 27 years for the state to finally admit culpability. They don't stop these people. They'll do it again. They are doing it again. As the Hillsborough Independent Panel showed in 2012 that Margaret Thatcher didn't give a damn about the victims and was only concerned about the devastating criticisms of the police. A memo from a senior civil servant made clear that Home Secretary Douglas Hurd in 1989 thought that South Yorkshire Chief Constable Peter Wright would have to resign, saying the enormity of this and the extent to which the inquiry blames the police demand this. But Thatcher made clear in a handwritten note she didn't want to give the government's backing to Lord Taylor's criticisms. She wanted to protect the police. And in 2016, the jury at the inquest into disaster found that the 96 people who died at the Hillsborough Football Stadium were unlawfully killed, and a catalogue of failings by the police and the ambulance services contributed to their deaths. Now, this vindicated the families, of course, who campaigned for years and years and years and years against the police's efforts to blame supporters for the tragedy. 27 years of lies, and today is the 30th anniversary of what happened to those people. Why didn't they just say back in 1989, we're really sorry, we screwed up, you know, we really messed up here, we screwed up, we made several massive mistakes and that contributed to the deaths of your sons and daughters. You know, I think the families could have gotten on with grieving then. I think they'd have hated to hear that, but I think they'd have accepted it and they'd have rebuilded their lives. Why 27 years of hardship, campaigning, all the pain, all the hurt? I'll tell you why. Because there is an evil at the heart of the establishment that's always been there. And it lets its mask slip every now and then. We saw it at Hillsborough for sure. Okay? We've seen it at other times since. Pure evil. Cannon fodder, the people are. The feelings of people, the hurt, the angst, the pain, the grief of people doesn't matter. The people are plebs. They're the great unwashed, to be trampled on, to be ridden roughshod over any time you want. And I wouldn't dare make a comparison with the Brexit vote, because I'm sure there are plenty of Liverpudlians who voted to remain in the European Union. But the utter contempt with which the people are being shown, you know, in political circles today. The disgrace of thousands of people a month being killed in Yemen with weapons made in this country by Saudi Arabia. A brutal, oppressive regime being supported by this government with military officers and with soldiers on the ground in Yemen. Utter contempt. Never forget what this establishment, what this ruling elite is capable of doing to people. And what they did to the people of Liverpool after the Hillsborough disaster of April 15th, 1989 is something that you should keep in your mind at all times when you're talking about the establishment. I'm going to move on in a sec, but I want to play a little clip from a Welsh broadcaster called Peter Jones, who witnessed this unfolding on that day from the BBC radio commentary box. And at the very end of the day, he filed a final report about it. And here's the end of it. Here's the tail end of his report, and then we'll move on.
Well, I think the biggest irony is that the sun is shining now and Hillsborough's quiet, and over there to the left, the green Yorkshire hills. And who would have known that people would die here in the stadium this afternoon? I don't necessarily want to reflect on Heysel, but I was there that night broadcasting with Emlyn Hughes, and he was sitting behind me this afternoon. And after half an hour of watching stretchers going out and oxygen cylinders being brought in and ambulance sirens screaming, he touched me on the shoulder and he said, "I can't take any more." And Emlyn Hughes left. The gymnasium here at Hillsborough is being used as a mortuary for the dead. And at this moment, stewards have got little paper bags and they're gathering up the personal belongings of the spectators. And there are red and white scarves of Liverpool and red and white bobble hats of Liverpool and red and white rosettes of Liverpool and nothing else. And the sun shines now.
When you walk through a storm.
Twenty-eight and a half minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live from Manchester on Fabric Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio and my website. Let's introduce my guest this hour. Before we do, let me just read you this big story today. A lot of big stories today, of course, but this one getting a lot of coverage. The Australian Rugby Union authorities have ended Israel Folau's contract over a social media post in which he said hell awaits gay people. He's got 48 hours to accept his sacking or face a code of conduct hearing. Rugby Australia said the 30-year-old had committed a high-level breach of the professional player's code of conduct, warranting termination of his employment contract. I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme. It's been ages, but somebody I'm very fond of. I've been speaking to him for many years. He's a human rights campaigner. Of course, he's originally from Australia. He's known, of course, for his work with LGBT rights, but he's campaigned for human rights for everybody for many, many, many years, decades, in fact. Peter Tatchell, welcome back to the programme. How are you, Peter?
Very glad to be with you, Richie.
Thanks for taking the call. What do you make of the firing of Israel Folau? I've been very interested to see today that commentators right across UK media seem to be coming down kind of 50-50. I've even seen one or two gay men and women saying, listen, if you're in favour of free speech, there are no buts or there are no ifs. You've got to support free speech, even those you disagree with. What's your take on the firing of this rugby union player? What do you think?
Well, I think by making those quite incendiary, inflammatory comments, Israel Folau is not only sending a message to the wider society, he's sending a message to his teammates and to other players. And I don't think we can tolerate a situation where on the sporting field, a player is racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, or Islamophobic. I don't think that is compatible with sport. Sport should be a prejudice-free zone where everyone is accepted based on merit. So if he'd said, you know, racist things, I think everybody would agree that that would be a red line and he should go. He said something that's equivalent, namely homophobic, and I think that's also grounds for him to go. Unless, and I add this, unless he does make a sincere apology and does something to commit himself to not discriminate and not act in a prejudiced way towards others who may be LGBT or T.
What are we saying then, Peter? Are we saying that if we find people in society who believe things that we find to be wrong or repugnant, that they should be ostracised or sent to Coventry or exiled in some way? Why can't his peers deal with him? You made an interesting point there about, you know, he will of course be coming up in his club and in his international career against men whom are gay. Let them deal with him, Peter. Doesn't it send a, isn't it a really dangerous thing when somebody is fired because of something he holds as a deeply personal belief, even if you and I would disagree with him?
Well, up to a point, yes, but he signed up to an organisation which has a policy that does not tolerate racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism and so on. So he has signed up to an organization and agreed to abide by the rules. He's broken the rules, so he can't complain.
He named a lot of people. I'm going to play you a little bit of audio. And this is from a woman called Miranda Devine. You probably have heard of Miranda. She writes for the Daily Telegraph in Australia. Mm-hmm. She's a conservative writer, no surprise there, right? But have a listen, Peter. Listen to what she says, and I'll get your comments on it in a minute. This is Miranda Devine speaking in favour of Israel Folau, sticking up for him effectively on Australian television yesterday morning.
Look, I think it's been a beat-up. He actually didn't single out homosexuals at all. He had just put this sort of litany that is a quote from the Bible of various behaviours that he said you have to repent, and that would be most of Australia. I mean, drunks, revelers, that's our national pastime. I'm a Catholic. He said that Catholics are heathens and idolaters. You know, we're all destined for hell. And he said yesterday when he was bailed up at church that he meant it in love, not in hatred. And I think that, you know, he's a fundamentalist Christian. Not many people are. It may not be your cup of tea. It's not mine. But he is perfectly entitled to express his beliefs privately on Instagram. And I think it's outrageous that Qantas, which has a deal with Emirates, which is a place where homosexuals are actually put to death, is actually carrying on so much and pressuring Rugby Australia to sack Israel Folau. And I hope that he does take it to court.
Right, Peter, what do you reckon to that? We can talk about Emirates and Qantas in a minute. But she says, look, he's named loads of people. Heathens, fornicators, atheists. I happen to be an atheist, Peter. It's who he is, she's saying. Stop picking on him. And his views are not widely held. Peter.
Well, I would agree that he should not be singled out just because of his views about gay people. But as I said, his litany of damnations and condemnations is clearly in violation of the Rugby Code of Conduct, which is an equal opportunities policy based on non-discrimination, based on inclusivity and acceptance. So an organization like a rugby association has a right to set out rules. And if you get involved or join that rugby club, you have an obligation to abide by the rules. And so, again, if he wants to be a part of this club, he's got to abide by the rules. And he's not clearly not abiding by the rules because he's targeting a whole host of people for quite abusive and quite, you know, well, not necessarily, not using abusive language, but he's using very strong language, you know, condemning people for being various things. And I don't think that is compatible with a sport which is supposed to be open to everyone. You know, we would not tolerate a white player using that kind of language against black people or Asian people, quite rightly. We would say, yes, that's a red line, he has to go. I don't see why homophobia or anti-Catholic or anti-heathen or whatever views should be taken differently.
Right. I love you. I've known you years and years and years. And you're incredibly strong. And I want to get into this, what I think is infantilization of people and groups of people. I want to get into this with you in a minute. But before that, we know the sort of fundamentalist church that he's associated with. Isn't there a glaring hypocrisy on behalf of the Australian rugby authorities? Because we know that Israel Folau goes to the church, and we know what's discussed in that church. So what are we saying then? We're saying that so long as they keep it to themselves, so long as he doesn't open his mouth about it, so long as he only does it behind the closed doors of his church, it's okay. That's, to me, grossly hypocritical, Peter. Because on the one, you can't have, I don't mean you, but the Australian rugby authorities can't have their cake and eat it. You know, either go the full hog. Because that's where we're going, I believe. We're going down the road of prosecuting thought crimes. We know this guy thinks this stuff anyway. Are we only now annoyed because he put it on Instagram? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but it's not a thought crime. He didn't think it. He expressed it publicly to all his followers.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, he's broadcast it and is seeking to influence people who follow him to share his particular prejudices against a whole host of different groups in society.
You know what I can't understand? By the way, Peter Tatchell is our guest, folks. Check out the Peter Tatchell Foundation. I'll tweet a link out to it. I'm sure you're well aware of it anyway. I'll tell you what really gets me about this. The reason I mentioned knowing you for years and the admiration I've always had for you, you're as hard as nails, Peter Tatchell. You remember a time when gay men and women would have bells knocked out of them if some group of yobs were to think that they were gay, you know, and you couldn't go into certain places in towns because you'd be chased and screamed at and abused and all of that. And real men and women campaigned and marched and changed the laws and worked and suffered that abuse, as you did and many others, for years and years and years, to be treated the same as everybody else. You didn't want any... Listen, if I'm misinterpreting you or misrepresenting you, jump right in. What gay and lesbian men and women wanted was to be treated the same as everybody else. I think that's been won, that fight. In this country... Look, we'll talk in a minute about the Middle East, fair enough. But in this country, and certainly in Australia, and certainly in the United States of America, that's been won. How could Israel Folau's Instagram post hurt somebody like Peter Tatchell? Come on, Peter. I mean, you just laugh at stuff like that, don't you, and just move on and ignore it.
It's not about me. It's about the fact that even today in Britain, one-third of all LGBT people, that's nearly a million people, have been victims of homophobic, biphobic, or transphobic hate crimes. Nearly 1 million. And for older people, sometimes they've been victims for not just once or twice, but even three or four times during their life. In our schools today, we are told that nearly half of all young LGBT kids in school have been bullied or victimized because of their sexual orientation or their gender identity. So quite clearly, we haven't yet won the battle. And when public figures like Israel Folau make these kind of statements, they reinforce and give credibility and legitimacy to those prejudices that drive hate crime and bullying in our schools.
I don't believe that, Peter. I don't believe they legitimize it. Go on.
Sorry?
I don't believe they legitimize it.
If Israel Folau was just a private individual and he said these comments, I would say that's shocking, but it shouldn't be criminalized or dragged up before the courts. But what is different, he is a public figure who has joined an organization, a rugby club governed by the rules of rugby, which says that prejudice has no place in any sport. So that's the rule. He's broken the rule, so he has to pay the consequences.
I'm going to say something now that you won't agree with, you won't like, and that's no bad thing. I don't believe the statistics. I don't believe them. And I'll tell you why I don't believe them. I grew up in Catholic Waterford City in Ireland. I went to Catholic primary school, a national school, and I went to a secondary school where we were taught Catholicism. We had a religious lesson once every week. This was in the late 80s, early 1990s. I grew up with it. And there were a couple of kids at school whom were gay and were known to be, and there were one or two kids whom people thought might be gay, and they put up with a bit of crap. But it was, it was in the very, very minor element that they did. The vast majority of kids didn't care. I'll tell you why I don't believe the statistics. Because I believe we're going down this Orwellian road. Now, you know me of old from the programmes I've presented over the years. And you'll say now, Richie's a conspiracy theorist, but I'm not. I believe that the establishment, the governments, whatever you want to call them, it wants to infantilise everybody. And it's creating vulnerable groups that we must never speak about, that we must never offend, or that we must never harm. And I believe they doctor up these statistics. Because I don't see in wider society this ostracization of, or this hatred of, gays and lesbians and transgender. I just don't see it, Peter. I believe that what this is really all about is attacking free speech, is attacking freedom of thought. We should all be able to live. We have to live with people like Israel Folau, and we shouldn't be firing him, this brilliant rugby player, even if he's thinking he's back in the Stone Age. And, you know, he's 27, 28, 30-year-old kid, whatever he is. That's what he's been exposed to. Those are his Christian fundamentalist views. And we can't, you know, just go to, you know, protecting ourselves or shutting ourselves away from everything which we disagree with or offends us. I would say the statistics are wrong. I don't believe them. And I'll argue this till I'm blue in the face, that gays and lesbians are subject to all of these attacks. Go ahead.
Well, can I just tell you, in the last week in London alone, I've read reports of two gay men being beaten up on the tube, three gay men being attacked coming out of a gay club. In my local area, a friend of mine saying that he was threatened shopping in the supermarket by a gang of boys. They're just three examples in the last week that I personally know about and have read about.
Right.
Now, you may be sceptical.
Not of what you're saying.
Statistics are exactly the way we are told. They are still substantial and unconscionable in a modern society. No one, no matter who they are, should have to live in fear, be looking over their shoulders out of fear that it might be attacked or threatened by someone who has a bigoted prejudice because they're black or Asian, gay, or maybe elderly, or maybe handicapped, maybe a woman. You know, we've got to get away from that.
We have laws, though, Peter.
We should not tolerate that.
No, and those lads you mentioned there. Listen, I used to go to a gay nightclub in Waterford City in the late 1990s. Why did I? Because I had friends whom were gay, one who's passed away now, and they were worried because it was in a more darker part of town, because it was the only venue they could get to have a night where gay singles could meet. They used to say, Richie, come along with us sometimes, because once or twice they encountered a bit of abuse from drunk idiots who were in an adjoining pub or whatever. But it was minor, this sort of stuff, right? And it went on. And I don't remember those lads. You know, I used to say to those lads, look, these are crimes. It doesn't matter whether you're gay, straight, whether you're boy, trans. It doesn't matter. If somebody comes up to you and screams in your face, threatens to hit you, these are crimes. We have laws to deal with that sort of stuff. I live in Manchester. I'm only a couple of miles from the city. And I understand from speaking to gay and lesbian folks here in the city, it's the safest place in the world to be. You know, Manchester City Centre, gay LGBT folks don't feel for a minute that they're in any danger. I think the fight has been won, Peter. I really do. I really do believe that. Guys like you won that fight. And you know something? I'm going to say this and then I'm going to shut up and get out of your way because I really want to hear your opinion on this. My listeners are sick of listening to me. Do you know what really, what I'm really worried about is, I think we've got no choice but to learn to live with the fact there will always be people who blame blacks for stuff. There will always be people who blame Muslims for their, you know, for their lives going bad. There will be people who don't like gays. We have to accept it, Peter. We can't say, well, we're going to change. Because we have
Why
to.
Why should we accept it? Why should we live with
Peter,
it?
Peter, we do. Because fundamentally, how can we... Look, I don't agree with them. I think they're wrong. But what am I going to do about that, Peter? Are we going to go down the Owen Jones and the Guardian route of sending them off for re-education camps? We can't do that. We've got to learn to live with them and accept it. Right, accept that they think like that. What can we do? As long as they're not breaking the law. As long as they're not going up to Peter Tatchell when he's out having a drink in his local and saying, F you, Tatchell, you dirty bastard and all of that. When they start that, bang him up, Peter. But when they're not, let them think what they want. Over to you.
Well, I would say that that is a recipe for a very disordered, disjointed, disharmonious society. I think, you know, thankfully, we are getting much, much better at dealing with racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, and so on. That's good. That's progress. And we must not give up the battle against those who still stand for those kind of values. Now, it doesn't mean to say they should all be locked up. No one's saying that Israel Folau should be sent to prison. I don't want that. But, you know, he is a sports person. He has agreed to abide by the rules of the rugby union or the rugby association, and therefore he, when he breaks those rules, has to be prepared to take the consequence.
Can I ask you a quick question?
He's actually said that he's prepared to take the consequences.
Which is really sad because he's committed to his religion. He believes this. Let me ask you this. Imagine you and me, we're working for a biscuit factory. me and Tatchell are on the production line, and Israel Folau is there, and we find out that Israel Folau says, I think homosexuality is wrong, I think it's evil. Should he be fired from the biscuit factory? I mean, are you happy to work there with him? Because I am. As long as he's not talking about it, as long as he's not saying it to you, let him think what he wants, is what I'm saying. Go ahead.
But he, in his post, which everybody's objecting, or lots of people are objecting to, he did say it publicly. He did say it to everyone.
Yeah.
He was broadcast. He wasn't saying, you know, he wasn't speaking to his friends in their house. He was putting this out to his probably millions of followers to give them a piece of his mind.
Yeah, but most of them would laugh at him, Peter.
I just think if we want to live in a cohesive, harmonious society where we get along with each other and people don't live in fear or don't feel intimidated, we have to say that, you know, these kind of abusive, prejudiced things don't have a place, and particularly when it comes to sport. Sport is supposed to be about merit, about who is the best, not what their race is, or their gender, or sexuality, or whatever. It's supposed to be about the talent on the field. And anything that blocks that or gets in the way undermines sport. Now, historically, a lot of gay people have not gone into sport because it's been homophobic. And as a result, sport has lost a lot of talented people. That's not only bad for the individual, it's bad for sport. And as long as we have people like Israel Folau stirring prejudice, there'll be people who think, oh, well, rugby not for me, because those kind of people play rugby, they make these anti-gay comments, and no one does anything. I don't want to be part of that.
Do you know what this leads to, though? And thanks for staying with me till the top of the hour, by the way. Peter Tatchell is our guest, a great, great human rights campaigner. They often unfairly label you, Peter, as an LGBT plus campaigner. It's unfair that you've campaigned for human rights for everybody for years and years and years, and you've always stood up for free speech. We've been talking about Israel Folau and his dismissal by the Australian authorities. I think you're wrong, and then I'm going to give you the final word. And I want to get a quick word on Julian Assange, but I'll tell you why I think you're wrong. Because your thinking leads to things like, so 20 morons make monkey chants at a football player during a football match, and the players decide to leave the pitch. That's where this leads. It leads to a kind of infantilization, a disempowerment of people who've already taken their power back. Israel Folau's millions of Instagram followers, Peter, are not fundamentalist Christians. They are people who would have read that post, rolled their eyes and went, what an arsehole. Christ, the guy can play rugby, but what an arsehole. And left it at that. And that's how I think society should deal with it. When I hear about if 20 goons in a 45,000 strong crowd make monkey noises, the players should leave the pitch. What? What about the 44,000 other supporters who are there paying your wages? Come on, Peter, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's good that racism is less common in football than it used to be. And that's because disciplinary action has been taken against players and fans. So that means black players and black fans feel safer and more included in sport. They feel able to go to watch a match without the fear of themselves being racially abused. I know people, black friends of mine from years ago, who would not go to football matches because they were subjected to monkey chants and had bananas thrown at them. Now, that's shocking that they didn't feel able to go to a football match to support the team they love because of the reaction of other fans. Thankfully, action has been taken to stop that kind of behavior, so now more black people feel able to go to football matches. I think that's a good thing.
I'm going to argue with you one more time on that, and then I'll get a comment off you on Assange. I've been a football supporter all my life, Peter. I've gone to watch Ireland. I've watched United hundreds of times. Do you know who's made things better on the terraces? The fans have. And they didn't need intervention from government or from agencies or from Kick It Out. The fans have always policed themselves. I've been present at a football match. Only once, it must be said, I'm not going to exaggerate it, when a fan was behaving like a plonker and was screaming at a football player called Graham Lasso. and he was making nasty comments about Graham Lasseau being gay and stuff like that. And the fans around him told him to shut his mouth or they would turf him out. The fans did it. We don't need to be policed by agencies of the government to tell us how to behave. We know how to behave is my final word on that. You can have a final word on it, of course, Peter, but I definitely want to get some thoughts on the imprisonment of Julian Assange and the concerns that he might be extradited to the United States, who want to exact revenge on him for his part in releasing very much in the public interest materials and leaks and videos, of course, over the years. Back to you, Peter.
Well, just on the final point on football, you're right. The fans have begun policing the anti, you know, the bigoted comments of some of their fellow fans. They have begun, and that's good. But they often have also not reacted. And there's been instances recently where there's been bigoted comments at some matches where most of the fans have not reacted. They've just sat on their hands. So I don't think it's easy to say that the fans will do the policing, that they will stop this prejudice. I salute those fans who have, and I know that in some instances they have done so successfully. But lots of occasions they haven't. And that is because we still live in a society where prejudice has a certain cachet among some people. And even those who perhaps don't like it too often sit on their hands, look the other way, or walk by on the other side of the stadium. So I'll finish on that and just to quickly go to Assange because I have to...
No, I appreciate that, call. Yeah.
Call in 3 minutes.
Thanks, Peter. What do you think of what's happened to Assange?
Well, first of all, he's got two issues. One is the extradition to the United States, which he definitely should not have to endure because, as you say, he released information about war crimes, human rights abuses and corruption by the United States government and military, which was in the public interest. He told the truth. Why ever is telling the truth wrong? Why should someone be criminalized for telling the truth? Thanks to him, we know things we didn't previously know. Things that are being kept hidden, cover-ups by the U.S. armed forces and military authorities, and of course, the U.S. government as well. Now, on that score, Theresa May should not be doing Donald Trump's dirty work by agreeing to extradite him to the United States. But there is another issue he faces, which is, of course, the issue of alleged sexual assault and even rape in Sweden. Now, I've always said, and Julian Assange has always said, he is willing to answer those allegations. So if you go back to 2010, he was originally questioned about these allegations in Sweden while he was there. And the prosecutors afterwards concluded there was no case to answer. Yeah. They told him he was free to leave Sweden, which he did. Then he came back to Britain, and sometime later, another prosecutor reopened the case and demanded to interview Assange. Well, he said, I'm in London. You're welcome to come here. I'm happy to talk to you. He was particularly afraid that if he went to Sweden, that the US might apply for an extradition warrant, which of course they have subsequently here in London, to extradite him to the US to face very, very serious charges over publicizing this wrongdoing by the US authorities. He said, you can come to London and interview me, which the Swedish authorities have done very, very many, many times. They've often come to Britain to interview criminal suspects. However, the Swedish authorities said, no, we're not coming to London. And thanks to freedom of information requests, we now know the British government intervened to advise the Swedish authorities not to come to London to interview Julian Assange. So the British government obstructed justice, and the Swedish authorities obstructed justice because they refused to come here to interview him. Eventually, I think 6 years later, they did agree to come to London and interview him. And then after they interviewed him, they decided they would not take any further action. Now we're in a situation where it's alleged that one of at least one of the women who are making the allegations of sexual assault wants the case reopened, and that prosecutors in Sweden are considering whether to reopen it. In my view, if they do reopen the case, then Julian Assange should go to Sweden. I think he should go voluntarily rather than being extradited to answer those charges. He says he's innocent. I don't know the facts of the case, but I think the women have to be believed and Julian Assange has to, be believed, and I think both deserve their day in court to set the matter right.
Yeah, you would hope, though, that the Swedish authorities would show some evidence to the UK authorities, evidence that would be compelling enough for the UK to agree to the extradition to Sweden. Final word on that, Peter. 10 seconds. Thanks for coming back.
Well, of course, yes. The Swedish authorities will have to provide some evidence to justify an extradition. But I think if the affidavits and that have previously been submitted are still standing, then I think the evidence is there, or sufficient evidence. But Julian Assange has never been charged with any offence. It's allegations, and until proven, the man is innocent.
Peter, thanks for coming back. PeterTatchellFoundation.org. Great to have you back on, Peter. Thanks for your time. Look after yourself.
Thank you, Richie.
Look after yourself. Bye for now. Peter Tatchell there. Another phone call coming in for him there from another radio station. Undoubtedly, the time is exactly 1.5 minutes past six. It's the Richie Allen Show for Monday, April 15th, 2019. Thanks for tuning in. I will get to the tweets now. Of course I will. There's plenty of tweets on lots of things. I know a lot of tweets came in when I was talking about the Hillsborough disaster earlier on. I'll try and get to some of those. I'll have to scroll way down there. Ricky tweets, you will always have an element of racism in football now and in 50 years. I would personally laugh it off. Well, I've got a lot of admiration for the Manchester City player Raheem Sterling, because he seems to be of the opinion the way to shut these guys up is just to bang the ball into the back of their goalkeeper's net, and then to celebrate, and then to walk off the pitch, having earned another great day's pay, and forget about the morons who might make monkey chants or who might say something stupid. No doubt, right? Base Ninja tweets, Richie, when I heard the comments made by Falau, to be honest, I thought he's lost his mind due to being indoctrinated into a fundamentalist religious ideology. He probably thinks the earth is 10,000 years old. Fine him. His statement is easily dismissed as Space Ninja there. Cartoon Drunk tweets, there's been a few rugby players come out as being gay, like Gareth Thomas, but there's been no football player ever to come out as gay. Definitely no top flight player anyway. But I think in recent seasons, hasn't there been players or a player in non-league or in League 2? I could be wrong now, but I think maybe there might have been one. But you're right, there must be gay men playing at the top level, and they've decided not to, for their own reasons, not to, you know, out themselves, for want of a better way of putting it. Mark Richards tweets, I hear that in the 1980s, at Cyril Regis, marvellous player, West Brom, Coventry City, Cyril got at them and scored goals, and that shut them up. That's right. Cyril Regis played for West Brom in the late 1970s under a couple of managers, Johnny Giles, I think, one of them, but Ron Atkinson. And I think there was Cyril Regis, there was Brendan Batson, who went on to have a good job at the Football Association, and I think there was Laurie Cunningham, who went on to play for Real Madrid, and I think he died very young, Laurie Cunningham. But they were three black players playing in one very good team in the 1970s. And I got to know a guy called Derek Statham when we lived in Spain. Derek was a marvellous fullback for West Brom. It's believed that the reason Derek didn't get dozens and dozens of caps for England is because Kenny Sansom was also a left back at the time. But Derek Statham played in that amazing team with the three black players who were known affectionately as the 3 Degrees. I reckon if there were three black players playing, you've got three wonderful players playing for Manchester United at the moment, up front. You've got Romelu Lukaku, who's from Belgium, he's black. You've got Anthony Martial from France, who's black, and you've got Marcus Rashford from just down the road from me, who's black. And I reckon if they were to be referred to as the 3 degrees, somebody would probably say that's racist. And yet, the three lads back in the 70s were known as the 3 degrees, because the 3 degrees, Sheila Ferguson and the ladies, were doing very well at the time. And nobody found that offensive, let alone the three players involved. Murray tweets, Peter Tatchell seems to have a closed mind on this subject. Well, you know my opinion, Murray. Faisal tweets, wasn't Hitler justifying his policies in saying that he was working for an orderly, harmonious society? I get the point you're making. But I think Peter is as far removed from Adolf Hitler as you can get. But I disagree with him. Peter believes that nobody should think what Israel Folau thinks. I say they should think whatever they want to think. And I will say it till my dying breath. And I do not think that they should be denied occupation. I don't think they should be denied a place in society. And the reason I think that is because most people just go, tut, tut, tut. I would say to Israel Folau, mind your business, pal. Mind your effing business. None of your business what people get up to in the privacy of their own homes. If you want to think they're going to hell, think whatever you want. But in terms of tweeting at people, mind your business. Now, let's have a drink. Because Israel Folau is not evil. He's not evil. He's not a menace to society. He's not a danger to children. He just thinks differently. And he's in the minority. And he has to be allowed to think what he wants. So you're talking about solicited or unsolicited comments. If Israel Folau is on a chat show with a top Australian talk presenter, and he or she says, well, what about those comments? He should be free to say what he wants. Well, I believe in God. I believe in the Old Testament or whatever. This is what I believe. I would say to him, and I hate the notion of self-censorship, I would say to him, don't be annoying people, Peter. Israel. Don't be annoying people. Leave him alone. None of your business, is what I would say. But we are moving towards the policing of thought and the criminalisation of thought. And it is deadly where that leads. We're also infantilising everybody. Oh, we've got to protect people. No, we don't. No, we don't. I've got gay friends in this city. They couldn't give an arse what Israel Folau says. They're not offended. They're not impositioned by it. They just say, couldn't give a shit. Couldn't give a shit. And that's where we should be. If I was running the Australian Rugby Union team, I would have said, listen, this is your final warning now. We have a code of conduct, as Peter Tatchell did point out. You think what you want, go to your church, preach what you want, but stop tweeting at people, telling them they're going to hell. Especially the fornicators. What have we ever done? What have we ever done to anybody? Nothing wrong with a bit of fornication. Filth, floor and filth. Nothing wrong with it at all. Shall we move on? We are moving towards the spectre of policing what people think. And Peter Tatchell, deep down in a place he doesn't want to admit, disagrees with that. And would be on my side, I think, there. So what about the eco-warriors in London today, then? The Extinction Rebellion, they call themselves. Did you see this bunch of weirdos today? Is that hate speech now? Is it hate speech to call these swampy types a bunch of weirdos? We're trying to cause massive disruption in London because they think that we don't take climate change as seriously as we should. You don't take climate change as seriously as you should? Well, we're going to block the fucking streets then. We're going to teach you. Oh, they say so. They say so. Climate change is real. CO2 is deadly. And it's making us all very hot. And it's causing hurricanes. and you have to believe it. And they must know, of course, these hemp-wearing, spliff-smoking, hair-dyeing, Linda McCartney-eating lovers of the planet, eh? Eh? Students and jobless wasters! I thought I'd come to work in fancy dress today. Today I've come as Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity rolled into one. Jobless, sweaty bastards! Shut up! Carbon dioxide is not destroying the planet. It's mental. So they blocked roads today and they parked a boat at Oxford Circus and they blocked Marble Arch. They were full of themselves with their woolly jumpers with the holes in them. Do you see what they wear? And their wellies. Morons. Apparently they smashed the glass of the revolving doors of Shell in London. Shell's headquarters in Waterloo. Very nice. What did they put on their bicycle chains? Fucking vegetable oil! What did they oil their bikes with? Don't get me started now. Do you want to hear some of these nuisances? These little narcissists. Sky followed them around today. We've got Sophie Cowan and Nathan Williams who want to save us from ourselves. It's an emergency, says Sophie Cowan. It's an emergency. Can we hear Sophie after all that? Can we hear Sophie? We can hear Sophie. We can hear Sophie. This is Sophie. It's a big emergency.
What we're making a point here is this really, really is an emergency.
It's an emergency!
And we talk about more people not being able to get to work. Well, those are going to be the first people that are going to be hit by the catastrophic results of climate change. I mean, we're looking at food shortages within 10 years. And actually, people, it's an abstract idea, and yet it is going to be a reality because the scientists are saying so.
Oh, the scientists are saying so. Ah, must be true then. Yes. If the scientists are saying so, young Sophie Cowan. Anything else?
So we really, really need to act now.
We need to act now. So we're going to cause chaos in London just to teach you unbelievers.
And what is the scale of what you're expecting the last few days? I mean, the numbers of people here at the moment, not as many as we've seen in the past. Is this really going to disrupt people, do you think?
Absolutely. It's going to disrupt the economics of London. We're here at Marble Arch down to Oxford Circus, which is one of the consumer lines of London. We're down at Parliament Square and Waterloo Bridge as well. It really is going to disrupt. And more than that, it's going to demonstrate to people what things should be. You know, things should...
Get back to uni, you lazy bastard.
There should be a recognition of...
Yeah, there should be a recognition. What about Nathan Williams? It's even worse.
Well, we're in the middle of a climate and ecological crisis.
A climate and ecological crisis, says Nathan.
That is already having catastrophic impacts for life on Earth and threatens to have even worse impacts in the very near future if governments don't act on this. And civil disobedience has become necessary because all the other measures of forcing governments to act have not worked. And we don't want to inconvenience people. But truthfully, the famines... and the mass migration that scientists are predicting will happen in the future will be a lot more inconvenient than some traffic disruption. Disruption forces into people's consciousnesses a problem and an issue and forces them to engage with the issue in a way they may not have done before.
Consciousnessness, it forces us to engage with the smelly swamp thing, Nathan Williams. Imagine they're blaming the media. We never hear the end of it from the media. The media won't shut up about it, about climate change and climate disaster. He said, we're going to tell you that famines and migration are on the way. But he's a bit late there, isn't he? He's a bit late there. What about the annihilation of Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen and Syria? I think we saw a bit of migration there, I think. And maybe a bit of famine, you know. But they're hilarious. You won't listen to us. So we're going to block the roads. It's a hoax. It's a hoax. And I'm going to read you something from... And I could be bumped off at any time, by the way, because I was told reliably by my provider, and this happened before, that sometime after 6, we're going to be bumped off. We're going to be offline for a few hours here in this part of South Manchester. But anyway, we'll see, right? We'll see. Let me read you from Francis Leader, the activist who was supposed to be on this programme this evening, and in light of the possible and probable disruption, I rearranged or rescheduled Francis for this coming Wednesday. Francis writes, the insane belief that the entire human race is responsible for wrecking the climate is fed to the young who have never seen a natural day of weather. How would they know any different? They are terrorized into taking illegal actions which will destroy their lives before they even get started. I wonder if any of them considered the fact that they will not be considered heroes by a prospective employer when he or she sees a conviction for criminal damage or obstruction of the highway on an application form. That was brilliant by Frances Leader, by the way. She writes, the eugenics program endorsed by the Rockefeller Institute, the Rothschilds, Maurice Strong and Al Gore came up with a way to unite the forces of rebellion and to achieve population reduction. They decided that they would gradually teach the world to be afraid of the climate whilst developing the technological advancements necessary to actively control the climate and use it as a weapon. This is marvellous stuff from Francis. Lockheed Martin proudly show on their website laser weapons mounted on trucks, helicopters and aircraft. But we do not hear of these being deployed in war zones. We do hear of beams from the sky setting fire to California, Portugal, Spain and Greece, though, don't we, writes Francis Leader. Magnificent stuff, this. I'll tweet a link out to this in a minute. It's on steamit.com. The young, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They haven't a clue. I said this on the programme before. Ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is celebrated. Celebrated. It doesn't matter that all the data on warming has been fabricated and skewed. Lies, we haven't seen any real warming in years. We're coming out of an ice age. The warming is natural. CO2 is not driving climate on the planet. The sun is. It's a fact. You know, they haven't a clue. They haven't a clue. And yet they celebrate their ignorance. Omar Barghouti was banned from entering the United States last week from Palestine. And he says that Israel has got Washington tied up in knots in suppressing the BDS movement in America. But he says, despite the efforts of Israel to destroy the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement in America, in fact, it's having an opposite effect. He says it's driving more people towards supporting the Palestinians. So he was stopped from travelling from Israel to America last week by American immigration authorities, despite the fact he had a valid visa. He was speaking with RT yesterday, didn't manage to fit this into Sunday View, but it's very important. And he said the United States was adopting even McCarthyite policies in order to please Israel. This is Omar Barghouti.
I was prevented from boarding a flight at Tel Aviv airport because under instructions from the U.S. consulate, U.S. immigration have banned me from entering the U.S. despite having a valid visa and valid travel documents. We see this as Israel outsourcing its McCarthyite anti-democratic repression against the BDS movement for human rights in Palestine to the United States. The U.S. administration has been mobilized now to do Israel's bidding in trying to silence Palestinian, Israeli and international human rights defenders who are active in this extremely important and very effective nonviolent BDS movement. I had a series of meetings and talks, meetings with policymakers in Congress, meetings with the media, talks at New York University, Harvard University, a bookstore in Philadelphia, and importantly, unprecedented meeting at a synagogue in Chicago, where we were going to discuss Passover, liberation, and the Palestinian BDS movement for Palestinian rights. And I was also headed to the US to attend my daughter's wedding.
They knew he was coming in as part of his trip to go to his daughter's wedding, but they denied him the visa. What a shower of heartless bastards, eh? What about the fact that 26 United States states, US states, have passed laws banning those states from entering into contracts with companies who support BDS in Palestine? I made a complete bags of that, didn't I? He was asked about the fact that states have passed laws preventing themselves from doing business with companies who support BDS and Palestine. What did he make of that?
The American Civil Liberties Union, which is a very important civil rights organization in the United States, has called that a form of McCarthyism, loyalty oaths that were prominent during the McCarthy era. It was then against communists, now it's against Palestine supporters. It is really a violation of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. As far back as 1982, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that boycotts for political, social, and economic change are considered free speech, protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So all those 27 states are following Israel's orders, basically, but they're violating the U.S. Constitution. We will challenge that. We are challenging that in U.S. courts. ACLU is challenging at least three states on their anti-democratic, anti-BDS laws, and we think we will prevail in that struggle. Israel is trying to suppress BDS from above by passing laws because it has miserably failed to stop the immense growth of the movement at the grassroots level.
Yeah, he's good. I don't tell other people what to do. I don't. You've never heard me tell you what to do. I choose not to buy anything that's manufactured in Israel. It's not because I blame all the Israelis for what's happening in Gaza. Of course I don't. And I'd prefer to refer to the country as Palestine anyway. I don't blame all the Israelis for it. Of course not. But that's how you deal with people. You force the people of that part of the world to take action against their own government. My quarrel is not with ordinary Jews who live in Tel Aviv and live in Jerusalem. Not at all. It's with their successive governments. So you sanction them back to the Stone Age, is what I would do, until they turn on their own governments and say enough's enough. This was reported by Newsweek last month, dear listener, but it's been in the news again this weekend. France apparently is seeing a wave of attacks against Christian churches. You might have heard this. And apparently it's been happening since the turn of the year. And French Christians are saying nobody cares about us and that people would care if it was against another religious denomination or a minority. Now, I'm not a Christian. I'm just saying I don't cover much of this, let's be honest. And nationalists and those who are religious criticise me sometimes for not covering this stuff more. So I say, okay, I'll cover whatever you want me to cover. French Christians are saying this is outrageous. Shouldn't happen. And apparently, the historic church of Saint-Sulpice in Paris was set on fire last month just after a midday mass. Love a good mass, me. Any time for a good mass. Ellen Fantini represents the Observatory on Intolerance Against Christians and discusses this. Are there lots of attacks against Christian churches in France? It looks like there are, and nobody seems to care. Ellen Fantini.
According to the French Observatoire de la Christianophobie, February 2019 was the worst month for churches in France since they began collecting data in 2015. But in addition to churches, other public Christian symbols have also been targeted. For example, summit crosses on mountaintops, public crucifixes have been destroyed or vandalized, and public statues of Jesus and the Virgin Mary have been decapitated or destroyed. What was
decapitating and destroying statues, you would have thought this would have made UK news, wouldn't you? But I've never heard of this. Yeah. To be fair, you know I've not got a religious bone in my body. I don't. To be fair, they do have a point. You could imagine if it was a mosque or a synagogue, there would be murders about this, wouldn't there?
Shocking to me was the almost casual way that the ministry described it, saying, quote, the number of anti-Christian acts is stable over the year. When the interior minister downplays or seems to sideline the acts against Christians, it fuels the assumption that only minority religions deserve protection. Unquestionably, the increase in anti-Semitic attacks is of serious concern, but by minimizing the number of anti-Christian incidents and providing no details, the government signals in a not-so-subtle way that this is less important.
You couldn't make this shit up. I put this program together this afternoon and I planned on pushing my luck till about 6:30 in case I get bumped off, and I think I probably will get bumped off any minute now, which is why there isn't a guest this hour. And it was after 3 when I got the clip of Ellen Fantini about fires and about damage to churches. And as I'm doing the segment live on the Richie Allen Show, my listeners, Faisal and Cocobell, my musician pal, and others are telling me that Notre Dame Cathedral is on fire in Paris at the moment. And in fact, as I go to the BBC and to the Independent, they're right, there's a major operation underway in Paris at the moment, and the photographs are quite startling. Flames shooting out of the steeple of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Widespread smoke everywhere, flames, and social media is, I won't say aflame, no puns here, but social media is ablaze, I won't say ablaze, no puns. But it's a major operation. Hopefully there was nobody in there, firstly. And secondly, what an amazing building that is, Notre Dame Cathedral. And let's hope that they get the fire under control very quickly. What a coincidence that is, talking to you about these things going on in France and Christians being very annoyed about the fact that they're not taken seriously. As I'm reading the story, these reports are coming in. Maybe it won't have anything to do with sabotage. Maybe it will. Maybe it will. We'll have a look at that tomorrow, won't we? On the Richie Allen Show tomorrow, I suppose. Look, I'm going to say this, and then I'm going to bid you adieu. Adieu for today. We're all meant to think that we're under attack, right? Now, please bombard me with abusive tweets if you think I'm wrong. I will read them tomorrow. We are all being conditioned to think that our group is under attack. This is identity politics. That doesn't mean that I'm gaslighting people. I'm not. Because everybody is under attack. It's a fact. But we are being conditioned to think that it's just us. It's just us. It's just white people. No. Yes, white people are under attack. The notion of nationalism is being put under attack. It's become a dirty word. People who are nationalist in their thinking are being equated to dirty, underhand, racist, and they're not. Yes, everybody is under attack. But not exclusively. They're playing us all. White people under attack. Christians are under attack. Yes. But look what they're doing in the Middle East. Look what's happening in Africa. Massive corporations from China. From China. And from Russia. And from America. Not so many. Raping the country. Look at what's happening in Southern Europe with the European Union. Nobody's being attacked exclusively. There is, as Francis Leader said, Agenda 21, Agenda 30, depopulation agendas. And it's not exclusively against white people or black people. We're all under the gun, every one of us. And until we figure that out, we're never going to move on, is my opinion. Number of you are making Quasimodo jokes. Maybe Quasimodo did it. Maybe Quasimodo got the hump. Boom, boom, boom. Maybe Quasimodo did. Listen, massive thanks to you for listening and for the tweets. Massive shout out to Peter Tatchell for coming on the programme. I know you disagree with him. But I disagreed with him. That's lovely, isn't it? Learn to live with those who see the world differently than you. Makes life all the more easy. And ultimately, it's the path to redemption. It's the path to redemption. Engaging with people who see things a bit differently. I'll be back with you tomorrow with two brilliant guests. I will be joined from Red Ice Media tomorrow by Lana Lochteff. Lana joins the programme tomorrow. And I'll also be joined even by an extraordinary woman called Shirley De Bono. And she joins me tomorrow to talk about the incarceration of young men in this country for years. Not at the behest of a judge. Not because they were found guilty of some crime that warranted them being locked away for years, but locked away because it's in the public interest. Going to talk about that tomorrow, and I'll have Lana Lochteff on the show as well. Closing out the show with Billy Joel. Look after yourselves and one another. It's been a good Monday, I think. See you tomorrow with plenty more. Enjoy the rest of your Monday evening. Until we speak again, it's bye from me. Bye now.